Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. I'm John Norman. Alongside me for today's show, Jared Kimber. And on today's show, we're going to take you back 10 years, almost to the day when the cricket world was rocked by arguably the biggest sporting scoop of them all. It was Sunday, August the 29th. The headline on the News of the World said one word, caught. And beneath it, a picture of a man sitting beside a table, counting what turned out to be £140,000. The man? Well, he was a cricket agent, and a cricket agent to five high-profile members of the Pakistani side who were touring England that year. His name was Mazhar Majeed, and by the end of the year, he and three of those players, Salman Butt, Mohammad Asif and Mohammad Amir, would be found guilty of conspiracy to cheat at gambling and conspiracy to accept corrupt payments. They would all go on to serve prison sentences. But how exactly did it come to that? How did those three international cricketers allow themselves to be embroiled in the murky world of match fixing? How did the authorities come to find out? And what happened afterwards? You'll hear the answer to all those questions and plenty more over the next hour. You're listening to The Cricket Collective with the Institute of Cricket.
You know what? The near balls are the easiest, yeah, and then the most clear. Then there's no risk, there's no signal. They're definitely happening. There's no signal, nothing. These three are definitely happening. Yeah, they're all being organised. Okay. So the first ball of the third over.
Okay, first ball of the third over. Winning. Right. So who's going to be opening?
That is going to be Armour. Armour's going to be bowled the first over.
No balls. A call. Front foot. No ball.
Oh, it's a big no ball. Maybe. He's finding it a little difficult because of the wet patches.
Then the tenth, the last ball, sixth ball, or the tenth over?
Last ball of?
The tenth over.
Tenth over. Who's bowling it? Asif
is bowling it.
Just oversteps on the front line and looks as if he wants a bit of sawdust. It might be quite greasy.
Seen a couple of biggish no balls actually. One from Amir. He was over that front line by a good half a foot or so.
Well, welcome to the show. And the reason we're talking about this story after this time is because of the publication of a new book. It's called The Thin White Line. It's written by Nick Greenslade, who works for the Sunday Times, and it chronicles in real detail exactly how this incredible story came about. With testimony from many of those involved at ground level in the sting itself, the journalists involved in the scoop, the lawyers who took part in the subsequent hearings, as well as opposition players on the field at the time, and ICC bigwigs. You hear many shows, books and articles described as a definitive take on a particular subject, but I think that accurately describes this book in question. I'm pleased to say Nick Greenslade's with us in the studio. Nick, thanks for joining us on the Cricket Collective. Let's start at the beginning, because this was a scoop for the ages, wasn't it?
Yes, well, firstly, thanks for that generous introduction. I mean, I think it remains the biggest sports news scoop that I've ever been around in terms of what unfolded. I think there's a point in the book in which I explain there's a meeting at the News of the World, and Tom Crone, who is the News of the lawyer, says, "I think in my 26 years of working at the News of the World, this is the most amazing story I've ever worked on, because something is going to happen in a Lord's test and we can report that we knew about it in advance." And lo and behold, they did. And that thing they knew about was three no balls bowled to order by two high-profile Pakistan players, instructed to do so by their Pakistan captain, who himself, as you said earlier, was working on instructions from their agent. Now, we've never had anything quite like that in cricket, if you think about it, where people knew in advance. Obviously, we had the Hansi Cronje scandal in 2000, where Cronje, the South African captain, took money from Indian bookmakers to engineer a result in a match against England. Cronje was exposed 4 or 5 months later and subsequently banned for cricket. But in this instance, A, we had the advance knowledge on the part of the journalists. So on whatever it was, Sunday the 29th of August, 2-3 days after those no balls had been bowled, it was plastered all over the front page of the paper. And secondly, all three subsequently stood criminal trial. Cronje never did that. And in fact, you know, there was a lot of debating amongst the Crown Prosecution Service at the time as to how they were going to charge these three cricketers, because nothing had ever really come up like this before. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the case is that they bowled three no balls, mistakenly thinking that another fixer was going to put money on them and make even more money out of that via the underworld bookmaking syndicates. In fact, no bookmaker would ever take a bet for a no ball, because it's quite clearly open to individual corruption. You'd be mad if a punter came to you and said, I want to have a £10,000 on a no ball being bowled in the third ball of the fifth over. Anyone with a brain would say, thanks, but no thanks. So no one had gone to the bookies and put a bet down. So it wasn't technically fraud in that sense. They managed to find some element of the statute book where they could bring charges and prosecute them. And lo and behold, those three cricketers, plus their agent, stood trial at Southwark Crown Court. I think it was 15 months after the incident at Lord's. All four of them received custodial sentences. Again, we're talking about international cricketers serving time, Pakistan cricketers serving time in England. And then subsequently released. And then we have the story of Mohammed Amir, the 18-year-old at the time, who was quite clearly groomed by both his agent and his captain, Salman Butt, to deliver the no ball. The cricket community suddenly realised that this was a guy caught up in something way, way bigger than him, who had been groomed, as I said, and this idea that actually we should show some sort of leniency towards him. And again, it was people within the English cricket game who led that process. So Mike Atherton of the Times and Mike Brearley, they had worked with Amir's legal team to offer as much help as they could. Atherton did his first interview after his release. Brearley and Atherton both wrote to the ICC. And lo and behold, 6 years later, he's back at Lord's. His first test is back at Lord's for Pakistan. Takes the final wicket as Pakistan win. And is actually now back in England for the... has been back in England for the T20 series. He actually wasn't due to come to this country. He was going to stay at home for the birth of his second child, but decided at the last minute. So 10 years on, we've got him back in this country, although the other two, there's no route back into the Pakistan side for the other two.
I mean, Nick, I think it's worth talking about Salman Butt quite a bit. You know, you've talked about the crime. So when this first came out, I sort of started talking to my sources at the ICC, and they knew that he was up to something. I believe in the World T20 in 2009, was it?
Yeah.
That he had something between 5 and 7 different phones on him. There's also, as you talk about in the book, the famous test in Sydney, where Pakistan went from an incredible position where you probably would lose maybe 1 in 30 times. I think the odds were about 40 or 50 to 1 to losing that test. There were plenty of signs around cricket that this was going on, but the problem is that the way that you know the people who look into cricket, the anti-corruption unit, they don't have the ability to set up stings like this, and also because of the international nature, it makes it almost impossible for them to police the game correctly.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. The Sydney test, this was in January 2010 between Australia and Pakistan, when, as you say, Pakistan threw away what was seemed an impregnable position to win. It's a matter of public record that that was under investigation. They were looking into that. And in fact, the same source who had tipped off News of the World reporter Mazen Mahmood about Mazen Majeed had also tipped off the ICC around the same time. Now, the ICC struck up a correspondence with that source, and they'd seen some of the text messages as well, which he had come to and from his BlackBerry phone, which suggested criminality. But as you say, they weren't able to, because they don't have the powers of a law enforcement agency. They can't subpoena bank records. They can't look at phone records, etc. There was very little to do. They did consider briefly what we would probably now consider an entrapment operation, but decided that legally that would be they'd be entering into a very grey area. We do know that, as you said, Butt was already under suspicion. He had many different phones, and of course, you're supposed to register all your different phones with the ICC to avoid any shadow of doubt as to what you might be up to. They were already looking at that. There'd been a scene also, I think, during the Asia Cup in Sri Lanka, or either the Asia Cup in Sri Lanka in June 2010 or the World T20 in the Caribbean in just before then, when I think Mohamed Amir had been seen on the team balcony during a game on his phone. Now, that's a very bad breach of phone protocol in terms of what you're supposed to do with your mobile phone during a match. So you can't be seen to be contacting anyone who might want to influence the game. So there was a very high level of suspicion around Butt. There was a very high level of suspicion around Pakistan, unfortunately. I don't want to single out one particular country, because this is a problem which has engulfed cricket in general. But the problem with Pakistan at the time particularly is that their players were probably among the least paid of international cricketers. This was especially true when they weren't allowed to play in the burgeoning Indian Premier League from 2009. So, you know, if you think about our cricketers, England star cricketers, you know, extremely well paid by comparison with their peers. But what, you know, what if they weren't? You know, if you're not earning very much from playing Test cricket and you see lots of other people earning huge amounts who might not even be better players, is that where the temptation comes in? Certainly that came in for Salman Butt. You know, he was quite open about that in his conversations with his agent. He saw other players within the Pakistan team, within world cricket, earning huge amounts. And he thought, well, why am I not? Why is none of that money coming my way? And the decision, the road he decided to go down was towards the fixing road.
No ball, it's a call. Front foot. No ball.
It just doesn't look good. It just doesn't look good. I know, and he went over by a distance. You know, it was not just a small no ball, and we haven't seen that from him before. But it is so sad, David, an 18-year-old with that sort of talent, and then for him to be getting involved in this. I'm absolutely sure he didn't go looking for anyone. Someone has dragged him into this, and it is so sad.
Somebody has dragged them into it. That's the words of Michael Holding talking about the then 17-year-old, 18-year-old Mohamed Amir. Also, Ian Botham, Sir Ian Botham, calling the no ball live on Sky Sports Cricket. The year was 2010. The location was Lords, and the test match taking place between England and Pakistan. Pakistan had been 2-0 down in that series, fought their way back into it. Should have drawn that series 2-2. You mentioned earlier on, Nick, we're talking about the release of The Thin White Line, how Pakistan had often been embroiled in these kind of stories. Actually, if you read your book towards the end, we are reminded, if we didn't need to know, that it's not just Pakistan who get themselves embroiled in these kind of stories. It's pretty much every team and a lot of different players from a lot of different countries. There's no test-playing country that can say it hasn't had a player embroiled in a story along these lines. But it wasn't even the first time Mazia Mahmood, the investigative journalist who really is the fulcrum of this story, the book itself you spoke to at length, had released a story about Pakistani fixing, because back in the year 2000, he had infiltrated an international match-fixing ring headed by cricket legend Salim Malik. Salim Malik was one of two players at the time who were banned by the Qayyum report, I may have pronounced that incorrectly, a report that also mentioned a host of very, very famous names who still get wheeled out in front of the cameras every time Pakistan come to this country. It's something that always surprises me, and I don't think cricket does itself any favours in just kind of sugarcoating this kind of topic. But give me an idea of the role that Mazia Mahmood, a guy who himself would end up on the other side of the law, a few years later, played in getting this story to print, to trial, and also the role he played speaking to you in getting this book printed as well?
So we go back to early 2010. Mazen Mahmoud's the chief investigations editor, reporter for the News of the World, probably the most famous controversial news reporter of his era. He gets a tip-off from a source which he has described as somebody who was involved in Pakistani cricket management, saying, look, there's this guy, Mazen Mahmoud. He's an agent to, we don't know, whether it's three, four, five, six players within the Pakistan squad. He's up to no good. You need to look into him. Now, Mazen Mahmoud gets lots of tips off like this every week about whether it's sport, politics, crime, people doing wrongdoing. And he says, look, I'd love to do more on it, but I've got nothing to go on here other than rumour and innuendo. Fast forward 5-6 months, the start of the summer 2010. The same source comes to him and says, look, I'm attaching various messages to and from Majid's BlackBerry phone, which I've got hold of. Have a look at those because they are clear evidence of wrongdoing. And sure enough, they are clear evidence of wrongdoing. And what it also gives Mazen Mahmoud is contact numbers, how to get hold of this guy. So within a week or so, he's on to him. He said, and this is where, as Mahmoud has done countless times before, he poses as an alter ego. In this case, it's an Indian businessman who has got contacts out in the Far East, wants to set up a T20 tournament in the Middle East, where obviously there's a huge Asian expat community, and therefore approaches Mahmoud saying, I need some Pakistan cricketers, what can you do? So at a series of meetings, and these meetings all take place in the course of about a week or so, he lures Mazen Mahmoud in. Initially, it's a sort of, it's a wink-wink, nudge-nudge kind of thing. You know, Mahmoud or rather his alter ego says, look, you know, there may be other opportunities for your guys to make more money, if you know what I mean. And Mahmoud said, yes, I do know exactly what you mean. I'm already up to that kind of thing. You know, betting, you know, what can we do here? And they get sucked, and Mahmoud gets sucked further and further in because he can sniff money. Mazen Mahmoud's alter ego looks extremely wealthy and his backers sound incredibly wealthy. So Majid's thinking, great, you know, this could be my meal ticket for the next couple of years. I just got to keep this guy on side. So Mahmoud this is almost the genius of Mazen Mahmoud as an investigative journalist. He doesn't rush in. He just slowly reels the guy in and wins over his confidence. And then they come to what I describe as the money shot. You know, they're going to meet. They meet at a West London hotel, and Mahmoud has asked for three no balls to be bowled. And Mahmoud said, OK, my price is £150,000. He'd already handed over £10,000, which is why the final delivery was £140,000. They meet in a suite in this West London hotel. And of course, Mazen Mahmoud, as he's done countless times before in these kinds of investigations, has rigged up the room with various audio and video surveillance equipment. So it's all there on camera. It's all there on tape. Giving the exact times at which these no balls are bowled. Lo and behold, the test unfolds a day later. We get the first two no balls exactly on the timing. We get the third no ball the day later because there's a rain break. So the News of the World story is pretty much, you know, cast iron. There's a couple of other things which are interesting to look at in terms of how the news went about this. And we talk about, we've seen this summer, and increasingly in cricket, we've seen a lot of no balls which actually weren't picked up by umpires just because of the way the DRS system works now as a backup. Now, obviously, that didn't really exist then. So what the News of the World did, thought, right, we've got this guy, he's promising to deliver no balls at certain times. However, there's always the chance that an umpire won't pick it up, which did, in fact, happen. You may recall in the Old Trafford test in 2001 involving England and Pakistan, when actually the Pakistanis picked up four wickets, I think, on no balls, just because the umpire didn't notice at the time. Anyway, so what they did is they got a photographer in the ground, said, right, you need to train your lens on the popping crease, obviously the line over which the transgressions can occur. You need to have your lens focused on that every ball, so that even if the umpire doesn't pick it up, we've got photographic evidence that this was a clear no ball, and we can present that, whether it's if we ever get any libel action or indeed in a police investigation. Anyway, so going back maybe 24 hours, huge excitement in the news of the world when the test starts. Rain delay on the day one, but they're all gathered around the key protagonist in the editor's office. First part works brilliant because Salmon Butt wins the toss and decides to bolt. So that means the no balls are going to come soon. So that's great. That's perfect. And then we get to, I think it's the third ball. It's a third over. Mohammed Amir runs in. It's reasonable enough ball. And I think Strauss scrambles through for a single. And sure enough, there it is. Umpire holding up his arm. No ball. I mean, that is journalistic gold. As I say, you cannot believe, you know, to be as I said, this, what Tom Crone, the lawyer, said, we knew in advance this was going to happen, and it happened. And then later, I think the final ball of the 10th over, Mohammed Asif delivers on time and on the money. So 2 out of 3, that's a pretty good story.
It's a very good story.
But what about the third part of the hat-trick? And this is where it gets quite interesting. So that first day of the Lord's Test, I think England got to 30-odd for one, and then the heavens opened, they went off for the day. No play. There's then frantic exchanges of text message and phone messages between Majid and his three bowlers, Majid and Mahmood. When's the third no ball going to come? You know, what's going to happen? When are they going to be back on play on day two? Day two comes round, and it's still not quite clear if they're going to get that third ball. There's one point where Mazen Majid texts Mazen Mahmood to say it's not on. And the reason for that is that Mohammed Amir is in bowling the spell of his life. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. 4 wickets in 10 balls at the start of day two. So there's carnage amongst the England dressing room, batsmen walking in and out. And Majid's thinking, can he really get away with bowling a no ball? And Mazen Mahmood goes back, look, I don't really care. We need this. We need the third no ball. Now, obviously, Majid's not in a position to influence it because the cricketers are on the outfield at Lord's. But again, sure enough, Mohammed Amir delivers a no ball. And I think that's the one where both and
The big one
where Michael Holding says, wow, how big over the line was that? And, you know, you look at that and think, that's a whopper. So, I mean, there's delight, you know, exultation, you know, within the News of the World offices because, you know, they've landed, you know, one of the biggest stories they'll ever get. And I don't think they'll ever, those journalists who involved that have ever come close to matching that kind of adrenaline rush. I mean, you would have an adrenaline rush if you'd given £140,000 away in cash, which is a hell of a lot of money by even the News of the World standards, which was the biggest newspaper of its kind in the age. And then there's two important things that the News of the World then have to do. Because this is a crime, they have to work with the Metropolitan Police in advance of going to publication. Now, the News of the World and Met Police had very close contacts, and some would say very controversial contacts over the years. But
the book goes into this in quite a lot of detail.
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of public record. I'm not saying anything that wasn't already known, because a lot of Mazen Mahmood's investigations were criminal investigations, which involved bringing in the forces of the law. So we're now onto the Friday night, which is sort of 36 hours before the News of the World will be available in newsagents. And Colin Myler, the editor of the News of the World, calls up Paul Stevenson, who's head of the Met, said, we've got a big story on corruption. You need to come in and see what we've got. We need to show you the evidence. And Steven says, OK, fine, you'll have a team with you tomorrow morning, Saturday morning. It'll be headed up by one of my assistant commissioners, Cressida Dick, who now subsequently got Stevenson's role, head of the Met, and, bizarrely, a cricket fan herself. In fact, one of the strange things about this book, when I started working on it, was one of the journalists in my contact said, oh, he said, you need to listen to, there's a thing on the radio where Cressida Dick's talking about her love of cricket. And she says, I was at the test, the Lord's test on the Thursday. I was there with my friend. I'm a big fan of Pakistan cricket, not just cricket in general. Anyway, she comes in with her team on Saturday morning. They look at the evidence. It's a pretty slam dunk case, you know. They take away the evidence. They say to Mazen Mahmood, said, right, we're going to look at this. Well, don't worry, we'll be going to Lord's this afternoon to carry out our inquiries. We need you to do one thing for us. We need you to arrange a meeting with Mazen Majeed, the agent, at 6:25 at his house, just so we know exactly where he'll be, so we can swoop on his house and arrest him, which Mazen Majeed does. And then she moves off to Lourdes. And the moment play finishes on what is now day three of the test, they let the Pakistan players know why they're there. There's searches of their hotel room. It's now by 9 p.m. on Saturday evening. It's out on news wires. It's out on television stations. The whole world knows. And then you get this very strange atmosphere at Lourdes on Sunday where nobody quite knows where to look as Pakistan meekly lose a test match and their final humiliation is complete.
And there's more to come. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. On next week's show, we're going to be looking back at NatWest Cricket Forces Community Day, getting ready for a new season of club cricket. What a different show that's going to be to this one. That took place at Finchley Cricket Ground. And thanks to NatWest Cricket Force. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. I'm joined by Nick Greenslade, author of The Thin White Line. Jarrod Kimber also alongside me. And still to come, we're going to speak to Usman Samiuddin from ESPN Cricket Info and also find out what happened after the events at Lourdes. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The allegations are only one thing. They're all serious, whether they're small or big.
Could I ask, Salman, are the allegations true? The evidence looks pretty damning in the paper this morning.
No allegations are true till they're proved either way. So at this point in time, they're just allegations.
Are you going to either resign as a Pakistani captain or not? There are serious allegations against you. Are you going to resign or not?
Can I come into this? I don't think one should ask whether you will resign on allegations.
Why can't Salman say whether the allegations that involve you are true or not?
Anybody can stand out and say anything about you, doesn't make them true.
So you're saying that they're false?
I haven't heard any allegation except just taking my name. There's nothing that I've seen or shown on TV or nothing that involves me.
You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. Myself, John Norman, Jarrod Kimber, and also Nick Greenslade, author of a new book, 10 years after the 2010 Pakistani spot-fixing affair. It's called The Thin White Line. I'm pleased to say that senior editor at ESPN Cricket Info, Usman Samiuddin, is in the UK following Pakistan's current tour of England. Usman, we're looking back to 2010, a story unfortunately we all know very well. Can you give us an idea? We've been talking about the reaction that took place in England when at 10 p.m. on a Sunday night, on national news, it was announced that there was some serious allegations about spot fixing, no balls to order. And then, of course, the following day in the news of the world, front page, caught. That was the front page. Cricket agents with bundles of cash that was marked and found in the dressing rooms of the Pakistani captain Salman Butt and also Mohammed Amir, Mohammed Asif. Well, there was no cash in his room, actually, but all three were found guilty. Can you give us an idea of the reaction in 2010 in Pakistan to this story and also now, 2020?
There was obviously some shock in Pakistan at the time. I think the first, the country was going through such a period that I think the first thing that a lot of people did at that time was to assume that this had been part of some conspiracy and that they had been set up somehow. I'm not saying that was that was everyone's reaction, but there was a body of opinion there for a while after it, actually. And the kind of, and this was pretty much, as Nick's book, in fact, shows, it's an excellent book, actually, but as it shows, it was just about the most open and shut case of some kind of fixing having happened on the cricket field that you're ever likely to get. There was eventually shock. And I think then there was just a lot of, I guess, some anger, some self-reflection at why it was still happening. Because if you remember, 2010 was actually 10 years on from the Qayyum report in Pakistan. So that marked the end of that kind of decade where, the Qayyum report had identified that match fixing had been going on the previous decade. And it had sanctioned, 8 Pakistani cricketers. 2 of them had gotten life bans. And so it came at the end of that 10 years after that. And I think a lot of people were just, wondering why it is still an issue. And it had been kind of an issue throughout that entire decade. So I think there was, some anger, some self-reflection, some denial as well. And now here we are, it feels like it was yesterday still, but here we are 10 years down the line from that day.
And, within Pakistan cricket and especially the journalism area, I mean, the Sydney test wasn't that long before. There was obviously a lot of suspicion about that. And Salman Butt, there had already started to be rumours about him before News of the World sort of even started. Were you starting to hear things as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but the thing at that time... and I remember writing actually about it because we did a package at Cricket Info on 10 years on from match fixing, and that was referring to the 2000 cases. But we did this package. I remember writing and saying that it's difficult to know because there were so many allegations being thrown around. The people like Sarfraz Nawaz and other guys, they were just throwing allegations at everything. And so when Sydney happened, it did feel odd, but it also felt very much part of this narrative that, oh, yes, of course, everyone's going to think it's fixed. And, I tended to look at the fact that Kamran Akmal was just scrap as a keeper. And so, he dropped those catches. He missed that run out. And the team was, the team was iffy. There was a lot wrong with that team just as a cricket team. So I looked at it from that point of view as well. And you had to kind of sift through what allegations were real. I think the first real sign was that the ACSU at that time had sent a couple of letters to Salman Butt and Kamran Akmal after the World T20 that year. So that was before the England tour, but after Sydney, they had sent them letters saying that, we know that you're in touch with suspicious characters and please answer for yourself. And that we'd kind of gotten a sniff of that. And that, I think, confirmed to a lot of journalists at the time that hang about, there is something actually dodgy going on. How deep and how far back it goes, we didn't know. And I think in a way we still don't. But I think that was the first thing that, okay, something's up here.
Usman, if you look at, you mentioned 2010 and we may mention it earlier in the show, actually. In the year 2000, then 2010 spot fixing. But, since then, there's still been so many Pakistani players, not just Pakistani players, plenty of players, maybe a Pakistaner unfairly, tainted with this because of previous misdemeanours. But, Nasir, this is detailed in the book. It's quite a list, isn't it? Umar Akmal, who was actually in and around the Pakistan side in 2010, brother of Kamran Akmal, of course. That was quite some missed run out at the SCG. Nasir Jamshed, he's been found
guilty.
In jail
right now.
In jail right now. Shahjil Khan, Khalid Latif, Mohammed Irfan, Shahzad Hassan. That it's quite a list, isn't it? Is it a Pakistani problem or is it a cricket problem or is it both?
It's not. I don't think it's specifically a Pakistani problem, but what it does tell you about Pakistan is something about the systems and how porous it is, how little protection there is for players. Also, it tells you something about how poorly paid a lot of players are in Pakistan. I know they have the PSL now, but they existed until the PSL came out in 2016. they had effectively gone, what it had been 7 years, 8 years without being allowed to play in the richest league in the world, you know, which a lot of the best players of other countries had access to, and that's the IPL. Their own, obviously, pay structure is pretty poor compared to the rest of the world. You know, they're some of the lowest paid international cricketers going. And then there is, of course, you know, they don't have, I think, they do. I mean, they do have in place, you know, they have education programs in place so that players should be aware. And you would think, like Omar Akmal got done recently for failing to report an approach. Now, you know, if after 20 years of having seen this, after 10 years of having seen what happened to Mohammad Amir, Mohammad Asif, Salman Butt, after 10 years of actually enhanced rehab programs, enhanced education programs, so that they're sitting before every major competition that they have, major tour that they have, to sit down with an anti-corruption officer and he tells them that this is what you can get called off for, this is what you should not be doing. If you're still doing it after that, then I think, you know, it's on the player as well. And I think you look at somebody like that, which is why the PCB is fighting so hard to make sure that his ban remains and doesn't get reduced at the Court of Arbitration for Sports in Switzerland. They just need to get rid of people like that, essentially, you know, ultimately, because you're always going to have those kind of bad eggs. And I think you'll have them everywhere in the world. But I think what has also happened over the last 10 years is that, you know, a lot of new leagues have opened up. And I don't think these leagues are kind of, you know, hotbeds of corruption, but I think a lot of the infrastructure in place, and I think, you know, Jared has worked on some of these. I think a lot of the infrastructures in place are porous, so you can get through them. You know, the bookies and bettors can get through them and can attach themselves to players. And I think that's what happened with the PSL as well. You know, Shargeel, that was a big, big blow, by the way. Five guys from that second PSL, you know, caught spot fixing on the first day, essentially. It was bad, but I think it's to do with kind of, you know, systemic issues that cricket has, which get magnified in a place like Pakistan, where you have a big group of vast underpayment of players, essentially.
The thing is, though, aren't we just giving these people an out here? Because you're right, they don't get paid a great deal of money, a lot of these guys. They're not in the IPL, but it has been proved playing in the IPL does not end corruption, does it?
Yeah.
The Mudgal Committee's report to the Supreme Court in India gave 12 to 13 names of high-profile players alleged to be match-fixing. Now, those players' names were never released. They were granted protection that maybe the Pakistani players weren't granted. But we've also seen two teams in the IPL banned for 2 years because of match-fixing. This goes to the absolute heart of the game, doesn't it? Because it's not as though getting more money and playing in the top-flight leagues means that suddenly these players aren't match-fixing anymore.
Within every league, I mean, listen, ultimately there's no limit to greed, you know, and a player playing in the IPL, there's still grades of what they're getting paid. Now, somebody like Srishant, who got done for it, ultimately, I you would argue, you know, maybe he had his own reasons, but I think cricket, one, gives itself as a sport where it is kind of, you know, it is a sport, this kind of event-based sport where every ball is an event, where you can have a lot of betting. But the other problem, of course, is that there are no laws against match fixing in countries like India and Pakistan. Sri Lanka has just brought a law in, I think 2 years ago now, which actually is the first big thing. If you can prosecute these guys and actually send them to jail, well, that might be the best deterrent ultimately. But if you don't have any laws to prosecute them on, then what are you going to do? You know, so I think that is the first step, really, for any country, if you're going to get serious. And that's a little bit out of the hands of a lot of boards. You know, I mean, boards have some kind of influence over what they can do. But ultimately, if your country, if your parliament, if your lawmakers are not going to bring that law into play, and I know the PCB has tried to have this done in the past, but they've come up against a brick wall. So where do they go after that? Unless the country itself is willing to criminalize betting and the consequences of it, then maybe, you know, that is the ultimate deterrent. If you don't have that in place, then you're always going to struggle.
Hello, Osman. It's Nick here. I'd just like to ask you a question. Is it true that in Pakistan, people made the same distinction that a lot of people over here did, that Mohammed Amir, as the youngster, was deserving of sympathy and the other two were, you know, should have known a lot better?
Mm. To a degree, I think people did, but I think there was also a body of opinion, and I included myself in that, I don't think Amir was as naive and as much the child as was made out perhaps at the time. You know, he was always a bit smarter than that. But, you know, if you go through his case like you have been in the book, I think you can make a pretty clear case and see how easy it would have been for somebody like Salman Butt, but specifically somebody like Salman Butt, to actually manipulate a situation whereby Amir would have felt that, you know, if I don't do this, then I could be in more trouble than by doing it. You know, that doesn't at all, I think, absolve him of what happened. But I think you can make a case that, you know, Salman Butt kind of manipulated the situation. This young new guy, a year into his career, and you know, Pakistani cricket, the young cricketers come in. There's no security until ever, really. Only until you're kind of a great, like, you know, Wasim, Waqar, or Imran, that you do have some sense of security. But until then, you really don't at any level of the game. You know, you 40 test matches, you could still be dropped. 45 test matches, you could still be dropped just on a whim. Well, not on a whim, but, you know, for spurious kind of selectorial reasons or whatever. But I think that would have played into, you know, why Amir did what he did. And I think at the time there was a little bit of sympathy, but when I remember the reaction when he actually came back to Pakistan after he got out of prison, when he came back to Pakistan, there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of anger. And I think that's one of the reasons why he became a bit of a recluse and kind of stayed in his house essentially in Lahore for the next 4 years at least, and didn't see anybody, kind of shrunk his circle of friends and associates. And for a long time, didn't even want to come back to play cricket. You know, he was completely, he felt he'd been burnt by the game, by the people in it. And he wanted to move on. And I think he's kind of been compelled back into the game because, you know, that was his kind of living. He had to make some money from somewhere and he had to kind of live and support his family and this entire industry around him. And that's one of the reasons why he's come back into the game. But yeah, so I think it was mixed. There was definitely a lot more hatred, I think, towards and anger towards Asif. And specifically, I think Salman Butt, because he was a captain, and also because, you know, at the time, I don't think anybody thought of him as a particularly great player, and they always thought that he was a little bit kind of arrogant and standoffish. So I think that played into the kind of anger that was directed towards him and Asif much more than it was towards Amir.
Usman, thanks for joining us on the show. Fascinating to get that kind of insight. Usman Samiuddin, Senior Editor at ESPN Cricket Info. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with myself, John Norman, Jared Kimber alongside me, and also author of the new book, The Thin White Line, by Nick Greenslade.
No ball is a call. Front foot. No ball.
Oh, it's a big no ball. Maybe he's finding it a little difficult because of the wet patches.
No ball is a call, but that was a short ball that we were expecting with the field placed as it has. How far was that? Whoa.
That's like net bowling.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, John Norman, Jared Kimber alongside me. And we're talking about the release of The Thin White Line, the inside story of cricket's greatest scandal. It's written by the Sunday Times' Nick Greenslade, and he's with us in the studio this week. Nick, so we've got up to the point that the guys have been caught, essentially. And then pandemonium behind the scenes, because, of course, as you mentioned, this is a journalistic scoop. The Metropolitan Police have been involved and have been brought in. The dressing rooms, the agent have been questioned, their property or rather their hotel rooms searched. And now it's a question of getting the ICC involved. The drama then moves on after the players themselves, kind of as we heard from Salma Bat at the start of the last section, essentially putting forward the notion that this is a conspiracy. Again, it's Pakistan being picked on. All allegations, we of course now know that isn't true. But there was a lot of work done by ICC lawyers, followed by legal lawyers. This was a case that was set to run quite some distance. And you've got quite a lot of insight in the book about exactly what was going on in Dubai, where the ICC headquarters are, and also in London, Southwark Crown Court, not too far from the news building where we broadcast here, where the trial took place.
Yeah, well, as I say, the ICC chief executive of the time, Haroon Loga, had to fly into London straight away. This was such a big story that it required his presence. And ironically, he's holed up in the same hotel as the PCB chair, Ejaz Butt. And the ICC realised it's got a major scandal on its hands and it needs to resolve it as quickly as possible. The first step is to get the Pakistan Cricket Board to drop their players from the subsequent one-day series involving England. And that's not an automatic by any stretch of the imagination. The PCB still digging their heels, still talking of a conspiracy, a setup, whatever you want to call it, and refusing to leave those players out of the one-day series. They are eventually persuaded that is the right course of action, and charges are brought by the ICC against the three players. We then, in England, we have another almost squalid scandal played out as the England players and the PCB exchange a war of words when the PCB chairman, Ejaz Butt, says that actually the England players might be fixing. And Andrew Strauss, who's the captain of the England Test and One Day squad, is absolutely outraged by this, as you would imagine. And there's a special team meeting called with Hall, the fourth One Day International, where they discuss withdrawing from the whole series as a whole. They're subsequently talked round by Giles Clark, ECB chair, and they go on and they win the series. But there's really bad blood between the two camps, which I hadn't really appreciated at the time, just how much acrimony there had been between the England and the Pakistan camps. This was at a time, you may recall, when England were desperately trying to get to world number one. And, you know, you win a series 3-1, and then all of a sudden you're told that your efforts were basically part of a charade. You know, three Pakistan players were almost throwing the game. That ends September. At the same time, they're back at their HQ in Dubai. The ICC is saying, right, we need to bring charges against these three players. We've had a problem with Pakistan for a long time, as we discussed in the earlier part of the programme. Now, they choose to stick to the clear evidence presented in that fourth test at Lord's. I think because that was where it was easy to get a conviction, as it were, even though there had been lots of evidence beforehand, as we discussed, lots of rumours that maybe this had been going on beforehand. There's a slam dunk if they just stick to the Lord's test. So first of all, we have an initial, we have an appeal against suspension from the Pakistan players in Dubai, which is chucked out. And then we fast forward to Qatar, January 2011, which is the proper tribunal. You've got Michael Beloff, a very respected lawyer, and two others sitting on a panel judging the evidence, which is basically the news of the world's evidence. And one of those lawyers who was involved in representing the ICC basically said, as far as the evidence presented by the News of the World, Mazen Majeed, it was a Christmas present with the most beautiful wrapping and a lovely little bow on it. That was all. You only needed that. You only need to have him on the stand, and you've essentially were hurtling towards a guilty verdict. Now, even then, you've still got lots of, you know, rumours back in Pakistan. This is a conspiracy. But that is their careers effectively done for 5 years, which is the minimum ban they all receive as being convicted of corruption in terms of cricket. Still, we have to come forward to the criminal trial, which takes place in this country, because obviously it's a crime committed in London, which takes place in October 2011. And again, Mazen Mahmood is the star witness. But, you know, the Pakistanis, they weren't going to go down without a fight. Both Butt and Asif pleaded not guilty. And probably Asif had a better chance because the evidence against him wasn't quite as strong, but ultimately they were fighting a losing battle. And they received custodial sentences. And at this point, we find out that Mohammed Amir's already pleaded guilty because Amir's had a change of heart. He's seen the light. He's realised that he should come clean, if only because he'll get a reduced sentence. And they have to serve time in English jails. You know, I mean, this is where the crimes are bad, but I do have some sympathy for each of the three, because you can imagine what it's like, you know, if you're a Pakistani cricketer and suddenly you find yourself, I think they were in Wandsworth Prison, which is not a nice place for everyone, before they were transferred to Canterbury Prison. That must have been tough for them.
It's a very interesting one. When you talk about Asif, as you said, he didn't have the money in his hotel room, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they did at the in the trial was, I think they got the ICC lawyers to work out what the odds were,
yeah, that's right,
of those no balls going. What was the actual number? How unlikely was it that had just happened randomly at the time that News of the World were expecting it?
Do you know what? I can't remember the exact figure, but it's something like one in...
It's like 15 million to one or something. Yes, stupid.
It's something ridiculous. And of course, all the accused try to put out alternative explanations. So we had from Asif this idea that Butt had told him, run in hard, run in fast. And he said, well, of course, when you run in fast, it's more likely to account for a no ball. That's the explanation. We had Amir, when he was bowling, he did this, went through this ruse of looking at the crease and scraping his feet as if to say, you know, it was a slippery outfield. It's a mistake that anyone could have made. But the news of the world evidence, and B, as we said there, the statistical evidence, the chances of anyone being able to predict no balls at certain times, thrown in with the text message, the contact with the agent, the money being found in their possession, which obviously only applies to Amir and Butt, they never really stood a chance.
Nick, time is against us, unfortunately, but it's a fascinating book. It certainly brings it back. Has it really been 10 years? It certainly doesn't seem that way. The book, The Thin White Line, it's just been released, The Inside Story of Cricket's Greatest Scandal by Nick Greenslade, available Pitch Publishing. Thanks so much for joining us on The Cricket Collective, Nick. It's been a fascinating hour. Jared as well, good to get you on the show. We will be returning, of course. The Cricket Collective is back next week on TalkSport 2 between 6 and 7 o'clock on Tuesday night. Looking back at NatWest Cricket Force's Community Day and getting ready for a new season of club cricket at Finchley Cricket Ground. It's September, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.